Hey everyone, welcome back to the Overmatch Podcast. I'm your host Kevin, as usual, and today I am joined by a good friend of mine, Command Sergeant Major Lee Strong, who is in charge of all training in Special Forces and Army Special Forces, which is a massive school. Lee, thanks so very much for coming along and being here for the questions.
Well, Kevin, thanks for the invite.
So we've known each other for a long time. We've been friends. We were team sergeants at the same time in 3rd Special Forces Group. You were kind of the SIF company, the way it's organized. There's one sniper team, and that's not like people think that's a two-man team. It's a 12-man team of freaking level one snipers and two assault teams. And then one of those three team sergeants is in charge of the whole troop, and you were the troop sergeant major. So I kind of indirectly worked for you. You and I are very, very similar people in regards to training especially. So we worked together for a couple of years. We deployed together, and then I kind of went one way, you went the other. You were the G3 sergeant major in SF command when I was running G8. Actually, when I was a first sergeant, I was in Afghanistan when you were the first sergeant that you've got some stories about that place. That's a rough kind of deployment right there. You came in very young. You went to SF very young. So you've really, really evolved. And you've been in at least three different groups, right? Mm-hmm. So it probably helps you a lot as you know, this week, because you know what first group does. You know what seventh group does because you're seventh group CSM. I think that was something I lacked when I was running Force Mod, because I was equipping all the groups, and I've only been in third group, right? So not integrally understanding seventh group's mission, first group's mission, but luckily I had Brian Edwards there, who was the regiment CSM, who knows SF inside and out. I remember going to Brian when we were fielding the ASR numbers, and I'm like, Brian, what's an ODH? I don't know what that is. And he had to explain it to me. I was an E8, right? But that's going to stand to you. So I really appreciate you coming. I've been trying to put this together for a while because I keep getting questions about the Q course and selection and all. And I'm outdated. I'm a freaking has-been, man. I went to selection 20-something years ago, and I don't know. So we're going to get down in the weeds. I put a thing out in social media to solicit questions. So I've got some questions we'll get to later on. But I just want to get a kind of overview, and then we'll talk about the Q course, the pipeline, and all these specialty schools. All right, so there's kind of two pipelines how people get to the SF pipeline. You have the 18 extra program where kids join the Army to be a Green Beret, and they go through a certain path, and then you have the guys who are in the regular Army, like you and I, and they go to a certain path, and they all end up in the same Q course and selection. But there's kind of, it's kind of different how to get there. Do you want to talk through that piece?
Yeah, so an 18 X-ray walks in out recruiting station, talks to a recruiter. They sign an 18 X-ray contract. They'll ship off to one station.
Is there an age limit?
There is. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a minimum age and a max age. But there's waivers for everything, right? Yeah. If they're the right candidate, we'll waive it.
And there's a GT score you have to get, right?
And less so the age, it's maturity that matters, right? Mm-hmm. So we see a lot of young people that are mature beyond their years, and we see maybe guys in their 30s that are less mature, right? So yeah, we're willing to give anybody an opportunity. Mm-hmm. So they'll fill out that contract. They'll go off to one station unit training at Fort Moore, Georgia, which used to be Fort Benning. So infantry OSIT, followed by airborne school. And then after that, they're on a bus up to Fort Liberty, where they're received and integrated by us to start the 5-week prep course.
Okay.
The active duty enlisted, very similar to ours, is you're at your unit. You probably attended a recruiting brief, or you saw an online ad or whatever. You filled that out through a Special Operations Recruiting Battalion, and then you attended SFAS TDY from your unit, your home station.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the X-ray program. Mm-hmm. As they come in, so they do they come to Bragg here. What do they call Bragg now?
Fort Liberty.
Okay. Yeah. They come here. I'm just calling it Fort Bragg. So
that's fine.
They do a 5-week prep course for selection, right?
Right.
But the people coming from regular Army don't do that.
They don't. So no. We've opened it up. It's easier for individuals on Fort Bragg. So the prep course, the X-rays have a good chance of success because they have a 5-week preparation course.
Mm-hmm.
We've realized that. So if you're an active duty enlisted soldier and you want to come to the prep course, we will let you. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's a TDY cost to a unit to send somebody for 5 weeks to potentially never get you back, right? Like you're going to get selected, you're going to go to Q course, and my unit out in Hawaii somewhere might never see you again.
So they don't want to feel that bill, right? Yeah,
right. And that's a huge TDY cost. But right now, if you're in the 82nd, and your unit can afford that time to let you go, we'll take in the prep course.
Okay, cool. So as you go through selection, What's the, if you get selected, what's the pipeline has completely changed since you and I went, right? Is there a standard now, or do they jump around because they're trying to keep people employed, right? Is there a, this is first, this is second, this is third, or is it kind of you fit in where you can? You're saying
the order of the Q course?
The order of the Q course,
no,
yeah.
So it is, so for efficiency, because think of SWCC as like a factory assembly line, right? Once it's running efficient, you don't want to tool with it too much unless it's to be more efficient, right?
Yeah.
So generally what we see now, the blocks or the phases that they're set up is post-selection, the x-rays, or you know, if you're an E4 from the conventional Army, you're going to go to BLC, so PME. The captains will go to the captain's career course, and then from there they finish those two PME blocks for their own professional military education that we have to do as we're in the Army. You'll go to the small unit tactics phase, an MOS phase, Robin Sage, SEER and language.
Oh, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
So if you have a gap between phases, you can't go to a different phase. You have to keep in that way. That wasn't there a thing where you keep everybody together, you try to keep them together?
Oh, the IOD. That was yeah.
Okay, that's history, all gone. Yeah. How do you stop, as the guy in charge, how do you stop the good idea fairy? Because nobody ever got a bullet on their OER or their NCOER that said, excellent, kept everything the same because it was working, right? And human nature is to change and put your spin on it.
Right.
How do you mitigate that? Oh, because change is good, but change can be bad if it's done for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of good idea fairies out there.
There is.
A lot of times the DA civilians that have been there for 20, 30 years, they'll remind us of those good ideas and usually the time and phasing of when that occurred and what year and what commander and sergeant major
and why
had those
failed.
Great ideas.
And
why it wouldn't work. It's not to say we're not open for suggestions. Mm-hmm. So if we change anything, it's for the betterment of the course and to have a better end product. So it has to be for a reason. Every decision we make is usually a data-informed decision. We're going to do some upfront analysis. Does this make sense? And then we'll probably do a small test of that, right? We don't want to do too many changes at once because then you're trying to figure out when something goes wrong, oh, man, where did it go wrong? Versus do one small change, iterate, fail fast, fail forward, fail often, right?
Mm-hmm.
So or hey, we did this change. It didn't work. It's easier to go back to your last known point versus a whole bunch of change. So any change is going to be small. And it's going to be for the betterment of the course. And it's probably a very data-informed decision. But there's not as much change as you think.
No.
Like very little has changed. It's just I think there's a perception out there that things have changed, right?
There is, yeah. Let's talk about the SF pipeline real quick, and then we talk about PSYOPs and civil affairs. So when you come in, you basically go 18 X-ray or 18 Charlie, 18 Delta, 18 Bravo, or 18 Echo. Is that based off your GT score?
So there's a preference. So post-assessment selection, you fill out a preference sheet, and then we have a series of aptitudes and batteries that will measure your intellect and your probability of success against those MOSs next to your preferences. We and that is a very deliberate process. So as the board is going on at Camp McCall for selects, there's another board going on where we're looking at those scores to see where we best place you. And we do consider a service member's their preferences. So,
But if this guy's dumb as a box of rocks and he wants to be a medic, probably not going to happen.
But we've also learned, like, never underestimate somebody's motive, right? So, like, you know, if you and I are
I knew my capabilities. I want to be an 18 Bravo.
Yeah, you get the highest chance of success.
I was like, hey,
But both, like, language and your unit assignment, right? Like, maybe I want to be an 18 Bravo in Spanish in 7th group. That's like, there's three preferences going on there.
Yeah.
Do you actually have the ability to do those three things, right? So we consider all that. We generally try to get somebody their first or second choice of MOS, their first or second choice of language, and their first or second choice because of the language, the unit they're going to. Doesn't always line up that way.
Of course,
I don't know the number, but very rarely does somebody get their number four bottom choice, right? And there's always, there's flexibility there, right? If a service member, as they sign into the Q course, they do have an opportunity to like, hey, let me talk to a cadre, a sergeant major, and give this a shot. But we generally have enough data to see like these scores generate these results.
Yeah, so you probably know.
You don't want to put somebody in something they're going to fail, right? We're very aware of that. That's not to say we won't give you a try.
Right, but they're more likely to succeed if it's
something
they
want to do.
Yeah.
And I'll never underestimate like, though you might not have the aptitude to be a medic because it's a very challenging course, if your score is off by a couple points, we're going to go ahead and take that risk and give you a shot. And you'll probably, a lot of times, they impress us with those scores.
Yeah, or you'll be a really well-trained 18
Bravo.
I tell you, people think medics. I've had people ask me, you know, are medics allowed to go to sniper school? And you were a shooter first.
Yeah,
and some of the best snipers I know are freaking medics, and nothing happens without your medic.
for sure.
Like, they're such an essential part.
Absolutely.
Yeah? And I mean, a great Q course, the medical medical sergeant, great.
Nothing like it on the planet, man.
Yeah,
It is the best combat trauma medics on the planet.
You have MARSOC and SEALs, and everybody go to that school, right?
Yeah, the Marines still go. The SEALs now have their own pathway.
Okay, okay, yeah, yeah. So, 18 Echo, or 18 Echo course has. I assume that's been modernized now modern technology. Not so much of the that went away decades ago, but the Morse code, but networking and computers and all that kind of stuff is part of that course now and absolutely necessary. Communications, you know, I tell people, like, if you're an 18 Bravo, right, weapons don't change that much, right?
Yeah.
Medical procedures, not that much.
Right.
Charlie, not that. Echo changes every, like, I remember my 18 Echo, when I was a team sergeant in B23, he was a dog handler for 2 years, came back, he was the least trained Echo on the team. Because it had all changed so much and technology evolved so quickly.
Right.
That's you got to have the right guy for that.
In any course we're running, we have to balance this integration of technology and just evolution over time with those green skills, shoot, move, communicate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yeah, great, we have all sorts of awesome apps and devices that – you know, you can navigate and locate anywhere in the world, right? But we still got to teach you the basics of, here's a map, a compass, a protractor.
Mm-hmm.
We can throw a red dot on a pistol and you can shoot really good, but we're going to have a solid foundation of iron sights first.
Yeah.
So we're always going to teach you those baseline fundamentals and build from there. And every once in a while in a training environment scenario, we're going to take that cool kit away to reinforce those fundamentals, because you never know when the lights are going to go out and you have to fight.
Yeah, yeah, so. I like that. It's a hard balance, right?
Because with time being the biggest constraint, right?
Yeah,
because how many things can we pile on any pipeline course, an ODA, before it's just too much, right?
Yeah, something's got to give.
Yep.
Something's got to give. How do we, and this is one of the questions that was submitted by somebody on the social media, and it's a great question. How do we, historically in the U.S. military, we're bad at harnessing lessons learned from combat, right?
Yeah.
And the only way you can really harness them is put them in a schoolhouse, right? And we don't want to be relearning all the same mistakes that cost blood in combat, right? How does SWIC harness lessons learned, put them in the pipeline where we can keep that? Because combat veterans are less and less around these days, right? Because we've been out of combat for a little while. So guys like you are senior guys. Yeah. Guys like me have retired already. So how do we keep those lessons learned and build them into the school?
Yeah, so I think, you know, combat's a human endeavor, right? Like, there's certain things that'll never change. And though we might not have the direct experience, like, principle patrolling and tactics are, that has, like, the Ranger handbook hasn't evolved all that much. So those things, I think, there'll always be a solid foundation of that. And then how do you take those specific foundational skills with experience learned in combat through deployments and layer that on top? You're right. We are some experiences. Guys are retiring or they're more senior. So we are constantly engaging the operational force and drawing from that experience, capturing it. And whether it's manuals, we're reviewing all our courses and POIs, and we update those. We do a critical task site selection board. I don't know if you ever participate in those, but
we bring in
the operational force every 2 years or so on just about every POI, and we look at, like, hey, are we teaching the right things, or do we need to update those? And it's constantly evolving, but you got to manage that expectation of, because you can evolve sometimes too fast and get away from that foundational skill. So we balance it quite a bit. And then, you know, like, we just have great leaders. Like, any one of the committees, like Jason, you know, good friend of both of ours, he is constantly on the phone and he is talking to all those company sergeant leaders, that group, right? To, here's the product I'm putting out, here's the things I'm teaching. Does that meet your demand signal, right?
Right.
And that relationship from the operational force to the institution has to be a good relationship and has to be constant.
It does, it does. But, yeah, it's hard to harness all those lessons learned and institutionalize and learn from them, so we don't have to learn them again. But I thought that was a great question. So what are the, I assume the medic course has not changed that much, right? It's patching holes and
a lot more technology embedded
What about the 18 Bravo course? Like, people think, oh, I went through the last hard course. The 18 Bravo course wasn't very good when I went through, I'll be honest, right? I learned how to disassemble a lot of weapons. I learned I could disassemble a Dishka machine gun, a 12.7 Russian machine gun, right? We disassembled, like, hundreds of guns, right?
Yeah.
But we weren't taught we were taught what to think and not how to think broadly, right?
Yeah.
And I was taught, okay, 1911, you push this, you pull this, and the 1911s are so disassembled and assembled that you push three buttons and the whole thing fell apart. Yeah, I bought a 1911 when I graduated and I couldn't get it apart. I was beating on it, right? But I learned all these Soviet guns and Soviet and surface-to-air missiles and all that. The first range I went to when I was on an ODA, three locking blocks broke on a Beretta. The part that breaks more than any other part in any other gun, and I didn't know how to change it. Yeah. Nobody showed me, right? So it wasn't a great course. Now, it has evolved a lot since then.
I actually get this question quite a bit because everybody's overly concerned with change in the Q course. Mm-hmm. And what are you guys teaching over there? I think I can answer kind of all the MOSs with like, what are we training in the first place and who are we bringing in, right? So I would say if you think of the pipeline, the Q course, that assessment selection is critical. The thing we do, and I think we do better than anybody, is we bring in raw material in the form of human capital. Mm-hmm. That's the people that come to assessment selection. Mm-hmm. That is our foundation. If we were an assembly line building trucks, that's our steel frame. Mm-hmm. So the number one ingredient that I think I personally spend a lot of time and energy looking into is assessment selection, because before we even start training at the Q course, we got to have the right individual from day one. And we got to have the right cadre training you on day one.
It's huge.
So we bring in that raw material and human capital, and then you go through a bunch of training. Mm. Clearly, your experience, maybe my experience, they weren't so great, right? Mm.
Parts of it.
Right.
Rubbing sage for me was phenomenal.
Right.
Because I got to think outside the box, make decisions. I wasn't micromanaged.
The skills you're teaching or training are important. Mm-hmm. We have to teach them those things and build a foundation of that MOS. But ultimately, you want a person that is they're going to come into that with a mindset of, I'm a problem solver, I'm a lifelong learner, mm-hmm. and I know what resource to go to when I get to the real world, because there's just too much information to teach and train. So we definitely have a POI and things that, like, these are critical tasks mm-hmm. that you will learn as an 18, pick your MOS, right? But those things also need to be, like, we modulate with the operational environment. Like, you know, if we took something out of a course to throw something new in, there's probably something going on downrange mm-hmm. that is a higher demand signal than you know, like, maybe cutting time fuse is less important for an 18 Charlie than learning how to do, layered defense.
Right.
So,
but there's a balance with Green Berets, because it's a very unique force, because a lot of times you're training people on very basic stuff.
Right.
So you can't evolve too much because you still have to do that basic stuff.
But what you generally find is if you get the right person, you can throw them in just about any environment. Like, you and mm-hmm. I were, like, if I had to, I could run a mortar mm-hmm. range as mm-hmm. an 18 Charlie, because I would be like, man, this mm-hmm. pressure's on me. I got to do it. And let me go talk to some resources, being 18 mm-hmm. Bravos in these manuals.
Yeah.
And figure it out, right?
Yeah. Good Green Berets teach anything. Yeah, they teach how to fly a helicopter if you want them to, you know?
Yeah.
They watch a YouTube video and just.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to tile my bathroom. I can't find a contract to do it. I'm going to watch a YouTube video and go tile a bathroom, right?
Yeah. But I trained, me and Brian, I don't know if I should say his name, we trained the Oman SAS Officer Corps in leadership and VBSS, like retaking ships, you know. I was like, well, okay, I'll train it.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'll figure it out, yeah.
And I think, so the Q course, you think about it, like, MOSs are important and what we teach mm-hmm. there, but really what's important is the right person coming into that pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, like, half the stuff you learn, because there's so much information, how much do you retain, right? Mm-hmm. Versus, you get to your first team, oh man, I gotta go do this range or do this task. It's being able to plug back into that resource and you know, either relearn or evolve, you know.
Yeah.
So being a lifelong learner is probably a key to success of being a good Green Beret.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about PSYOPs and civil affairs real quick. Just explain to people what they are as MOSs.
Yeah, so the civil affairs, you know, I think they're, you know, kind of their bumper sticker right now is you know, is governance, right? And they are doing a lot of the shaping pre-conflict to you know, for that 1A conflict hits, that they can come in and reestablish that governance, right? But very much nested in it, when you think SF, Robin Sage, unconventional warfare, being able to come in and influence an environment, a catastrophic event happens, and then being able to provide that stability on the back half to get things back to normal. Mm-hmm. But they are, you know, our soft civil affairs governance masters. Mm-hmm. And then psychological operators, a lot of, you know, the pre-shaping ahead of time to how do we inform and influence an environment to make certain decisions, either for or a benefit or for mm-hmm. a deficit to an enemy adversary.
And they have their own selection and pipeline, right?
They do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I heard a rumor that the SF command were looking at integrating all three in one ODA. Is that a thing or no?
I mean, there's a lot of, like, talk going on mm-hmm. there, but I think It's that's a process. You've seen the Army process. There's a capabilities based assessment. Let's figure out what we need before we talk about who we need, right? Like what capability we need, and then what is the form follows function, right? Mm-hmm. So what's the function, and now what does the structure look like to make it work that way?
Before we get off the Q course, basically selection, and as you go through the pipeline, you're being evaluated on these attributes, right? Go ahead and go through them for me real quick.
Yeah, so the RSOF attributes. Everyone wants to know what's the secret to success, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's the first secret is you got to give it a try. If you don't show up, you can't make it.
Yep.
So it's not as hard as you think, and if you have a desire to do it, you got to sign up. So the second thing is if you're signing up, know why you're going there. Because if your intrinsic motivation or you don't know why you want to maybe pursue this kind of career and lifestyle. So if you don't know why you want to be there when you're day 10 out at SFAS, when it starts raining or it gets cold.
Mm-hmm. Your leg starts hurting.
You now have a convenient excuse to quit, right? Or voluntary withdraw. So I think knowing why you want to be there is important. And then the last one is just don't quit. Let the course and the cadre decide. So you don't know the standard. So do as best as you can on every event. And if you didn't do good, let that event go and focus on
the page.
That.
Turn the page. Next day. One day at a time.
Focus on that next event, and you might be surprised at the end. Right?
I remember when I was at selection, we were unloading MREs. It was like a friggin' 100 of us, right? So we're on the big line, passing the boxes, right? And you couldn't even get in anywhere. So I'm over here in the corner bullshit with somebody, and I look over, and the cadre's looking at me, and they're writing my name down. I'm like,
it gets in your head, right?
Yeah.
And you don't know what they're writing.
I envisioned them writing lazy piece of shit, roster number 320, whatever it was.
286. I'd say anybody that does go, don't overthink it. Don't overcomplicate it. Do the events. Doing the best you can. You don't know the standard, so if you're there at the end, the cadre and course side. If you make it, great. If you don't make it, you will have learned something from that experience. You will get counseled on the way out, and you will get some feedback that you won't get anywhere else. And
Is there a year mandatory where you can come back in a year?
And everything's waiverable, right? Like I get waivers quite a bit for somebody that they're 6 months in, and they're like, man, I'm ready to go, and I want to do this again. So I think just giving it your best shot, knowing why you want to be there, and just giving it a shot is key, right? But when you do go there, we measure you against the RSOF attributes. And I would say these apply as assessment selection, and they apply really as you go on to the operational force in your career, right? So RSOF attributes being integrity, courage, perseverance, personal responsibility, professionalism, adaptability, team player, and capability. You know, we define them on the back, and but these are the things you are measured and assessed against throughout your career. And almost any event you do out at Camp McCall in SFAS qualification course, we can tie back to one of these, right? You know, and like perseverance is an easy one. None of them are weighted, but like perseverance, like, hey, do you have grit and determination? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do when it is 35 degrees and raining and the chips are down?
You know, big muddy lake.
Right.
Chest deep.
Yeah. You know, or hey, like you had a bad day at land nav. You didn't find a single point. You got to go back on the course tomorrow. That's perseverance. That's somebody who is, hey, I'm going to keep doing this until somebody tells me to stop. That's an easy one to assess, and a lot of times we assess that through physical tasks. But how do you assess somebody's integrity, right? And there's a lot of dilemmas or decisions out there that, hey, is this a kind of person that is going to make what is their character is really what we're trying to get out of these. What decisions will you make when nobody's watching? Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, everybody always wants to talk about the physical task. What's the run time? What's the ruck time? Mm-hmm. How fast do I have to do the O course? And it's easy to focus on those metrics. And what I will tell you is these are way more important to us than your 5 mile run time. Now you do have a bare minimum 5 mile run time. You do have a bare minimum, number of push-ups you got to do. But what is almost unwavering to us is integrity, professionalism, adaptability, being a team player, and we have the resources. And you've seen it. You get to grouping on a team. Teams on a team can make somebody shoot better. We can take you to a strength coach and a dietitian and make you more physically fit. Mm-hmm. How do I improve somebody's integrity, right? So these are way more important when you're out there getting assessed and selected. And it really comes down to be a good person, be a good teammate, and go to every task thinking, am I living by and applying these? And here's the reality, like we all fail. Mm-hmm. Maybe there are probably at times where I was not in alignment with any one of these, but it's knowing that I was not in alignment with that and bringing myself back to it as fast as possible and contributing, right? That seems like, oh man, that's squishy and probably not the answer people want to hear, but for a cadre, that cadre standing there watching, candidate Owens, he was watching you make a decision probably at a point along a course or an event where he knows people makes bad decisions because those cadre have seen it hundreds
of
times.
Not helping unload MREs.
Oh, I mean, I'll tell you, like
integrity.
The cadre out there have seen the events so many times that they know out of the hundreds of people that come, they know when people are going to take the shortcut. They know when people are going to be the hardest worker on the team and when people are going to sandbag. And they are constantly observing. They're constantly watching. And it's very easy to take any event or task and tie it back to any one of these. And what you end up with is over a series of days, a series of events, multiple observations from multiple cadres and your peers.
Yeah.
It is very easy at the end of that to paint a picture of you as a person.
Yeah.
And then it really comes down to, is this a person that I want to work with on my team?
Yeah, and you're being selected for training, right? You're not being selected
suitability
as
for the qualification
suitability
course.
For qualification.
You have what it takes to do this next hurdle, which we call the qualification course. And you have demonstrated values and attributes consistent with ours.
Right.
And I'll tell you, you have those baseline skills to get you through the training, and you have the baseline character to fit in this organization. Everything else is easy.
I'm not going to say his name, but my sister's daughter, right? So my niece was married to an American citizen.
Yeah.
And they went back and were living in Ireland. They went back to Ireland when it was booming, and then the economy crashed, and they didn't have great jobs, and they were kind of living very, very, they were kind of broke, right? So he was thinking about coming back to the States and becoming a police officer, right?
Yeah.
And I was talking to my sister on the phone, and I was the first sergeant at WLC at the time.
Right.
And I said, why don't you go to the 18 X-ray program? And I got them on Zoom, and I explained what it was. And the first reaction was like, there's no way I could ever do that, right? And my niece was like, yeah, but you're... I said, I did it. And she was like, but you're a badass. Yeah. And first it was, I can't do that, right? There's no way,
right.
Because it's this mythical Green Beret, Special Operations.
Well, I mean, look at you and I, right? Like when people think Green Beret, they think 6 foot tall, 250 pounds and
Rambo.
Bulletproof.
Yeah.
I think you and I are 155 pounds soaking wet.
I'm a little more than that now, but I'm 5'7", right?
Right.
And that actually, that's a good conversation about the functional fitness piece that came out during the GWAT. Like these big, huge monsters that were eat too much too much water, and they're too hard to medevac to get
you
shot.
You consume more resources. We're more efficient.
Yes, we are. Yeah, but basically, there, my niece's husband, right? He came back. He came back. I told him the recruiter. We basic training, AIT, jump school, right? Selection, SOP C, selection. Yeah,
probably crushed it.
But didn't pass.
Oh, well.
Yeah, and then he was back in, I don't know, he finished it, but didn't get selected, right? And then he was back in training group, and he was trying to hum in and hand, and I was like, you better make a decision. The Army will make it for you. And the Army said, okay, great, boom, Alaska. Yeah. And they were like, oh, my God. Went to Alaska for a year, loved it. Came back to selection.
Yeah.
He's Green Beret in 7th Group now.
Yeah,
right?
Good for him.
So... This again, self-selecting really starts as a civilian or as an Army guy that goes, I can't do that. You absolutely can.
It's some of it we contribute to, right? Like we keep the myth alive because it makes us feel good, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, it's not as hard as you think. And we see them all. Like we have 6 foot tall, 250 pound cyborgs, and we have guys like you and I, 5'6", 150 pounds.
Yep.
And there are advantages and disadvantages to any event, right? Like maybe there's obstacles moving big, heavy stuff. And the larger, yoked guys maybe do well in those events. But when it comes to, hey, you and I now have to move the same load over a distance, that's where our, being lean and having cardio helps. But at the end
climbing up the side of buildings in Iraq and jumping from roof to roof in the middle of a gunfight.
Sure. But it comes down to we're all going to be graded and assessed against those same tasks.
Yep.
There are advantages and disadvantages based off, just sheer physical abilities and genetics, but you can do it. Anybody can do
you
it.
Can. I think there's a common misconception that, the cadre at selection are trying to weed out as many people as possible. It's just not true. The force needs people. Yeah. They're trying to just make, you guys are trying to make sure you get the right people because you owe it to the guys on the team.
And, I think you and I probably over our careers, you got to be open-minded, right? And first off, any diversity is always good, right? You don't want to be on an ODA with 10 guys at all like think the same.
Yeah.
You need to open that up. Then there's a certain point like shared values, beliefs, behaviors. You build this kind of team, and then there's just never judge a book by its cover. I think you and I have you see those individuals that physically maybe look like they're that total package, and then does that performance match their physique?
Not always.
And a lot of times performance and physique are not on the same playing field. I mean, I had a guy on my team that was a dive team, and his nickname was the Manatee.
Yeah.
Because he did not look like your typical combat diver, six-pack ab, bleach blonde hair.
You put him in the water, he's like...
and what was amazing was when, had I not known any better, you look at him, you're like, there's no way this guy is going to perform. And, he had probably one of the fastest 5-mile times on our team. He had one of the fastest swim times when he went down to dive school. And it was just an important lesson to never judge a book by its cover, right? Like your performance speaks volumes, right?
Yeah.
And You can never tell. So there's no cadre out there like, oh, well, yeah. Look at this scrawny guy, non-select. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have that power, right? It's a process. No. Yeah, no, it's not like I don't like him.
We're more focused on did you accomplish those tasks, and mm-hmm. do you demonstrate those values?
Mm-hmm. Great. So when you get through and you go to a team, right? This is one of the questions, and I'll get to the questions here in a second. What's available to you on a team for schools? I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah.
The free fall for all things gone, right?
Correct.
That just wasn't attainable, right? So everybody goes to static line school, right? And almost everybody goes to static line jump master. Some people, are we back to one free fall team per company?
One paid Halo team per battalion.
Okay.
So you'll have a Halo team in each company, but one is your primary that you're going to pool those resources so that they can get that high level of proficiency being Archangel or whatever it is.
Can you get a school coming right out of the Q course?
Or you can.
You can?
High performance is usually often rewarded.
Oh, it is.
If you reach out to your battalion or group CSM, you know where you're going, and they're willing to afford you that time and opportunity to go, and there's a slot. I mean, really the best time to get a student into training is when they're in student mode, right?
Yeah.
So, and this, the money of PCSing you. If it's two more months of you hanging out at SWCC to attend a course and it's available, it's two more months and you get some training before you show up to group, right?
Right.
And that's case by case, but we'll do it.
Right? Okay. But it's worth trying.
It is. I definitely think it's worth trying. Yeah. But also, like, don't be greedy, right?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Like,
yeah.
You should want to go to group and get on a team,
I know.
Right?
Should. Like, yeah.
Maybe I question your humility if you're out, you're looking for schools before you leave SWCC or trying to get to the first ODA.
What was the best school you went to in SF?
Oh, man.
Sephardic? Sephardic was up there.
Sephardic, probably the funnest school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, all the combat diver haters out there are going to be like, oh, here we go. But dive school was probably the best school I ever went to because I learned a lot about myself and a lot about teamwork. And it was the first time where I didn't know if I was going to pass or fail.
I
was uncomfortable.
I have a great story about dive school. Yeah. And you tell me if it's BS. So,
yeah.
And I talked to a dive instructor a while ago, and I was actually very encouraged by what he said. What they used to do, probably when you went, and they do that thing where they put you at the bottom of the pool, and they go in there, and they rip your mask off.
One-man comp.
They tie it in knots and stuff like that. And he had told me that they stopped doing that. They do things that will happen naturally in nature, right? Like your mask can get ripped off, right?
Right.
But the ocean's not going to tie it in a knot, right? So they stopped taking that out because it was BS, which I get that.
Right.
Is that accurate?
It's still there. we do a one
tight
minute.
A knot. Or do you?
I don't want to go through the sequence. And really, the sequence is demonstrating your confidence in the water and are you, because it comes down to safety. In the deep ocean at night.
Yeah.
Anything go wrong and you're tied to teammates and a bad decision from you could result in a safety incident or death of a teammate. So. Mm-hmm. That event is less so focused on your regulator being tied in a knot and more on do you display water confidence and can you work through this event under stress safely? And if you can't, can you make a safe ascent with you and your mates, right? We do it. But I think really what that school brings out is you're in an uncomfortable environment. You show up day one, you look to your left and right, and you're like, man, I'm an average individual today, right? Like I might not be the best guy here, right? It's an environment unlike a lot of other courses where maybe – and we're all humble guys, but there's a lot of courses you go to and you're like, yeah, I'm gonna have the fastest run time or PT score or I'm the best shooter. Key West is an environment where everybody's probably average, and if you're the best guy at something, you're the best guy at that one thing, not everything. I think it forces you to maybe perform to a level of uncomfortable performance, right? And then
the water's an uncomfortable environment for a lot of people.
And then you realize, like, everybody here is willing to go through this together. So it creates a very cohesive team environment. Mm. And then you have these cadre that have all been through that themselves that oftentimes they will jump in the water and demonstrate those things. You see a level of leader development and teamwork unlike any other school or environment I've been in, right? And we're not trying to be Navy SEALs. We're trying to be Army Green Berets. And the maritime infiltration capability we bring with that skill set. So we're not trying to be something we're not. But for me, I think that's the best school I went to because I was way outside my comfort zone. And it was just a really good culture, a really good environment.
It's good. It was a challenge.
Sephardic, absolutely the most fun. Like,
yeah.
Where else can you shoot that much ammo, blow stuff up, and like there's a guy there. Like, you could blow up a door, and 2 minutes later, like, there's an engineer hanging a new door, and you're blowing up the next one, right?
It was great. It was great. Yeah. School. That and sniper school for me were the two best
ones. It's
just
fun, aggressive. And honestly, like, less so, like, dive school, it was a great course for me on a level of I was uncomfortable, and I had a lot of personal growth and leadership growth there. Sephardic, I was directly able to take those skills and apply them in combat.
Yeah, and more so than any other. Any I other think. Skill, like, yeah, Sephardic is the CQB, hostage rescue, breaching.
You think of Sephardic and CIFSIC, of all the courses we run in our institution, like for the past 20 years, we have taken those skills and we have put them to good use downrange.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And some of our other skills are things that we've trained on, we maintain a level of proficiency on, and they're on a shelf for the maybe the day we get to use it. Whereas that was... I mean, it was lethality and survivability for the teams, right?
Yeah. If I'm a Green Beret on a team, and I know how it happened to me, but and I come up on SWIC orders, do I get to pick where I go work?
So things have changed the past year or two. We do a market now. So the levy requirements from SWIC and all the other organizations outside our group, those requirements come into HRC. HRC then, you know, pools the operational force. So who's eligible? Eligible based off your number of months team time.
Your school. You can't go to work at sniper school if you're not a sniper.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Your codes. But that eligibility pops up individual. So I'm an 18 Bravo on a team. I go into that market and I select my preference. Everything I'm available for, I preference.
Okay.
Once those preferences are in.
So the good old boy system's gone?
That market closes. And once the market closes, we're going to identify the best candidate for those jobs.
Okay.
That being said, there is... an opportunity as you arrive at SWIC or even before you arrive at SWIC, communicate through your leadership, your team sergeant, battalion, group CSM, and on the receiving end at SWIC, I generally want, and all the leaders at Echelon want, somebody to be at a job they want to do. And if that opportunity is there, we'll do it for you because you're going to do better at it.
You are.
The organization benefits, you benefit. Why would we not send you where you want to go? That being said, it doesn't always line up perfectly, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So you're in the Army.
Yeah.
Do what you're told.
Right? Yeah. And it's not as bad as you think, right?
Yeah.
Like
it's what you make of it,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
Let me get to some questions here.
For sure.
I know one of them already is, well, we talked about standards.
Yeah.
A couple of people asked me, but let me just go through it. How much is wokeness bled into SF? I know. You get this all the time, do you?
Yeah. Not all the time, but it does come up, right? I think there's a perception out there, and it's like, okay, like first, let's just define woke, right?
Yeah.
Like, is it, you know, whoever wrote the question, is it females? Is it diversity inclusion? Like, what I will tell you is we did a deep, deep study on our programs on just bias. Like, do we have any bias in our program? Are our standards what they standards are? And I was very impressed with and happy to say, like, we have one of the most fair programs on the planet. Like, if you come out, you accomplish a task, you demonstrate these values, you will be selected, and it doesn't matter what your race, your gender, your background is. And ultimately, like, as a team guy, why do I care? When you show up to team, are you going to be a good teammate and you're going to contribute to the value of our team and our mission?
There was never any of that on a team.
No.
Team guys are team guys. Yeah. And you don't even see it in that light. It's just so weird.
But I mean, it's a topic that comes up quite a bit, but I think it doesn't, because at the end of the day, we trust our process. And we are not concerned with your background or where you came from. We're concerned with why do you want to be here and will you perform to this level and live by these values. And if you do that, we will accept you as a teammate.
The other part of it is you're in the military. The military is owned by the government. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that come through the government that you have no control over, right? When I was a first sergeant, I had to photograph every tattoo on every guy. The Obama administration, I was looking for... you do what you're freaking told at a certain point, right?
Oh, yeah.
You only control certain things anyway.
It's funny. Even the name changing of installations and everybody likes to cherry pick things to basically sensationalize any topic, right? It's like if you actually knew how we got to the name Fort Liberty on Bragg, you'd be very, from Bragg to Liberty, you'd be very proud. You'd be like, man, it's a great change. I mean, you think of the concept of liberty, like how do you pick an installation like Fort Bragg to name after any one person? There's so many people that have done amazing things that have come out of that, both the airborne and RSOF community. To pick one name is just almost impossible when you think of the Medal of Honor recipients and things like that. And you think of the ideal of liberty, like, oh man, that's bigger than a person. It's a concept or a value that is nested into like our American way of life, right? And but people want to pick on those things.
I know. Get over it, man.
Yep. It's almost not worth talking about.
I know. Most common injury during training.
Yeah. So we see a lot of injuries.
Yeah.
So heat casualty is our highest injury in just volume and numbers is heat casualty. But
selection or throughout?
Throughout. And time of year doesn't matter, right? Like, heat casualty in December. Yeah, we have heat casualties all year.
I know that when I was at Camp McCall's first time, they had selection of these big vats of ice, and they stick candidates' arms in them. and it circulates the blood all the way. That, like, it really works well.
Here's
but,
what we,
but one of the guys that went through was telling me that a student went up there and he stuck his head in the ice and he started drinking the water. And like 500 people have had their sweaty arms
their,
in there.
Their arms beat. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's our number one injury as far as volume.
Yeah.
And they're generally low risk because of heat casualty and we have preventive measures like that. And there's the occasional like core body temperature, 103 hospital. So that's our number one. And like technology and where we're better as an organization of, you know, we look at the threshold and weather of events. We're willing to, you know, hey, do we adjust a 12-mile road march to if we do this 2 hours later in the day as the sun's setting? So there's a lot of like just better commander and instructor decisions.
Mitigation.
On how we do that. And then you see the VATS of whether you need to or not, as you're going down some of those run-ruck series, you're dunking because there's science behind. It lowers your core body temperature. And we'd rather see somebody lose 5 seconds on a run time to dunk real quick to prevent them from being a heat casualty tomorrow because of the accumulation effect of heat. So heat is the number one, and then actual injuries that might prevent you from finishing training. A lot of lower extremities, ankles, knees, hips, lower back, right? Because you're walking with heavy loads at night through the woods, and there's just a lot of things that trip and fall on. So a lot of rolled ankles, knees, hips, and lower back
injuries. I scratched my cornea in selection. I had a corneal abrasion.
Yeah.
So I was out there in the wood line with this eye drops that they gave me. I'm pouring it on my eyes. That hurt like
a I'll tell you, man, there's a – to be a medic out at Camp McCall or maybe somebody at the first health medical staff in Pinehurst when there's a class going on, you see some interesting stuff. So Jeff – our old company sergeant major Jeff.
Yep.
He's got some great stories now that he's working out there as a civilian. It'll be a good time. You talk to him about it.
We already talked about this one, but in selection, what qualities are the cadre looking for to set people apart, right?
Yeah, these.
Yep. RSARF attributes.
Yeah. And I mean, and none of them are weighted, right? Any event might take one or another out. I mean, a cadre might have something specifically in a candidate that he observed earlier that he's like, let me pay special attention to this attribute because I maybe got a false positive or negative on that last one. And a lot of times they know that, hey, I want to get a second look from other cadre to confirm or deny. So there's never one person observing any of these. But I think integrity, you got to have it. That is, they're all non-negotiable. But the situations you're going to find yourself in a soft career, we need people who have integrity, right? And honestly, perseverance, like you got to have some grit, man.
Yeah, like, you do. Yeah, you can't get rid of that, right? The rapid technology advancement, how does that affect training? Like I think we talked about that a little bit. You can only strap so much technology on a guy. Yeah. You just have to. I remember testing a piece of equipment for the military, and it was, I won't even go into it, but I couldn't revert back to a red dot within a second. I remember talking to one of our senior guys and go, if this fails, I need to be able to shoot, right? I need to be able to revert back. And it's the same with everything, right? GPSs are great, but you need to know how to use a map and compass, right? And that's the simplest kind of analogy. But how do you strap all that crap on people and still maintain that basic soldier skill?
Yeah, it's a constant balance of those foundational kind of green skills, shoot, move, communicate, with technology layered over top of it, right? And we're constantly evolving. So I think the benefits of technology, right? We can see, engage further and faster than ever before, right? And the battlefield is way more lethal than it was in our generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, a team sergeant's job now compared to what you and I went through, our job is easy, right?
Yeah.
So we're constantly evolving, but you always got to be able to go back to those baseline fundamentals. And we are at a point where, you know, technology is evolving so fast that, you know, can you keep up on the ODA or in a training institution with it, right? And you got to pick and choose the things that are non-negotiable and the things that, hey, you're going to layer on top. And then there's ways technology helps us through automation, right? Like a lot of human error may be taken out of some processes because we're automating systems.
Yeah.
We're still watching them, but we're offloading work from a person to a machine for the sake of your time, right? We're offloading a lot of times risk from a person to a machine.
Yeah.
And then there's things that humans absolutely need to do because assess, selection, and training is a human endeavor and combat is a human endeavor. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly balancing that.
Is SF training, I assume they mean selection, more of an individual task or a team-based?
Yeah, there's kind phases.
There's both, right?
So you have, there's an individual phase where we are looking specifically at you as a candidate. And then you're going to go to a collective kind of team phase, team week, where, all right, now that we know you're the right individual, you know, can you work on a team of people, you know, cross-cultural communication skills, right?
Yeah.
Like you might be the fastest 5-mile run time and the most tactical and technically like proficient person, but if you're a jerk, nobody wants to work with you. you know? We've had teammates like that.
You don't have to answer this. Do they still do peers?
They do.
They do. Okay. Best conventional unit you've worked with?
Man.
There's a lot of, and I never did this, probably because I was in the Civ Company, but these
uplift infantry
yeah. units who get attached to SF teams to beep up the firepower.
Yeah.
Great feedback on those guys.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've worked with Guard and Reserve units mm-hmm. as uplift that were awesome, right? And you wouldn't think that, like, has to be the 101st or 82nd mm-hmm. or 25th ID, but I think any unit I've worked with, they become part of your team, mm-hmm. right? Like, you get to whatever fire base or location, mm-hmm. and that uplift infantry is now, they're an extension of your ODA, and I'm just impressed with every unit I've ever worked with, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I've had attachments from 25th ID, the 101st, 82nd, and the National Guard. Mm-hmm. And every one of them, I just love soldiers, man.
They're, yeah.
What you generally get is people want to be good soldiers and they want to be good teammates. Mm-hmm. And with a little bit of training, mm-hmm. Everybody's,
treat them right. Everybody can be good. Yeah. You treat them right, they'll do anything
for you. So I couldn't name mm-hmm. one. And that's not me taking you're throwing a softball at it. I mean, soldiers are just, anytime you're working with soldiers, it's great.
Mm-hmm. I think we might have talked about the most common thing that people struggle with training in SF, maybe self-selection, maybe self-doubt.
Yeah, I think lack of mental or emotional resiliency, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think people generally physically prepare themselves very well. They get inside their own head, and they have a bad day or a bad task, mm-hmm. and they let that get to them
mm-hmm.
and just don't do it.
This is the one I talked to you earlier on about. How do you balance the need for candidates to excel at marksmanship, PT, land nav, all those traditional soldier skills yeah. that we were good at. How do you balance that against a soldier who is good at technology and yeah. has those skill sets and that aptitude to embrace technology and basically knuckle dragger, break shit, smart kid, right? How do you balance that, so, that when you're looking for candidates?
Oh, probably more so me than you. I look around this room right now. You got a tablet out there. High technology
yeah,
equipment.
Yeah.
This generation are very much they're data literate. They're digital mm-hmm. natives, right? They operate in this environment way better than we did.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the problems sometimes is us, our generation of we struggle to keep pace. Mm-hmm. We generally find like this newer, younger generation of soldier, they adapt to technology better than we have because they grew up with it. So it's almost easier for us to integrate technology into training with this current generation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we do focus more on, a little bit of ruggedization and resiliency,
mm-hmm.
shoot, move, communicate, because the technology stuff, like, we can put if we threw a device in a room that you and I have never touched, and let's say a recent graduate of the Q course maybe has never touched, mm-hmm. I guarantee you that individual will pick that thing up and in 5 minutes
yeah.
be operating it with almost no instruction, whereas you and I would mess around for hours hitting buttons.
Trying to open the box.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I think integration of technology is almost easier with this generation because they're so familiar with it.
Right.
So we do almost over-focus on the things that our generation was just right. familiar with. Like, we grew up in an army where you put heavy stuff in your back, you put your head down, you didn't ask questions, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. that wasn't a good way to train. Mm-hmm. But I think our focus naturally, because they're high level mm-hmm. proficiency with technology, our focus drifts towards let's get them running and rucking and doing soldier tasks.
It's probably easier to teach a nerd how to shoot than it is to teach a knuckle dragger how to do technology.
I would have thought that.
Yeah.
But we have some commandos these days.
Yeah.
That are secret. They're closet nerds, man.
Really?
Like 18 Bravos that like go yeah. home and code on weekends, right?
Really?
And you're like, yeah. Really, man? Like, and they're very comfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't judge a book by its cover, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Stevie, who is my medic on my team, who has taught for me. Stevie's a big freaking muscle. Yeah, yeah. Stevie's a highly intelligent guy, man. But he looks like a freaking bouncer in a nightclub, you know? Yeah.
I got this out of Popular Mechanics magazine.
National Guard versus active duty.
Yeah.
Any difference?
You talking about
candidates?
Candidates
for
the operator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think candidates, the Guard does really well at assessment selection.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they're in the Guard and they are attached to the 19th or 20th group. They get a good train up and they do very well at assessment selection and really the qualification course. Plus, they bring a lot of maturity and civilian real world experience into the military life, right? And I think operationally, like, having deployed downrange and worked with Guard and Reserve units, maybe less so. They're not as well equipped. Mm-hmm. There's maybe a little bit of, training deficiencies because they just don't get the same. They don't have the same equipment. They don't get the same training we do. But what I noticed once in the environment, they learn really quick and they evolve. And 3 months into a deployment, you wouldn't know the difference of a Guard, Reserve unit, or an active mm-hmm. duty unit.
It's actually a great
path.
If you have a job and you like your job, but you want to do this Army thing, you can play both both. You can play both sides. You can go get all the training, get all the schools, keep your regular job, and then go deploy and come back. And it's actually a great option for people.
On the flip side, too, maybe you've been a couple years on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
You want something else for yourself, for your family, but you're not ready to give this up completely. Like transition to the Guard Reserves, and you can still reach out and touch it and you know, be part of this. And it might be a smoother transition to being a civilian or a veteran going through a Guard Reserve than a hard stop right out of off active duty.
I know a lot of the when the GWAT kicked off and Afghanistan kicked off early, a lot of those units were Guard, and there were cops, you know, there were cops in the real world, and they were interrogating people, and they were doing stuff that SF guys weren't trained on yet. Is there a certain type that you've seen go through and be successful, or is it just all over the place? It's human. When you put in humans into it, it's just so much variables, right? I do see, when I was at the Warrior Leader course, I saw young, physically fit guys that you know, that were really motivated, and you could almost tell that they would be really good, but I don't know if that was just what I saw.
I mean, I'd love to say, you know, we could give you this personality test and predict with a 99% you know, positive rate that this individual will be successful. And but I think generally a good basis of physical fitness, that makes it easier on maybe some of the task side of things. When it comes to mental, emotional intelligence, those are the things that I think a lot of some of the scenarios and testing we do, you clearly can see a line of like, oh, these individuals have a high aptitude and cognitive ability, and they'll do very well at these things. But to be able to, you know, say, hey, this is the one thing now, I think you never know. Never judge a book by its cover.
Yeah, right? There's too much human involved, right? What's the most sought after school in Zwick?
Sephardic and Halo School.
Is it? Halo? Yeah, I guess because people don't get to go. Me and you got to go, and you know.
You know, like we're going to fill both those courses max capacity, right?
Yeah.
They're fun.
Somebody asked about free fall school, but I was free fall qualified. I was a free fall jump master, and I was an 80 grad too, and I never liked jumping. I just did it because it was my job.
Part of your job.
Part of my job. I was like, okay, here we go. Fall out of the bird again, you know. I will tell you that free fall in the military is not like civilian skydiving.
No, it is.
they will get you. Like, you'll do accelerated free fall. You jump with instructors, but as soon as you get comfortable with something, then they strap a rock on you.
We'll strap a refrigerator to you if they could, right?
Yeah. Like, and then as soon as you get comfortable with that, oxygen mask. And as soon as you get comfortable with that, turn the lights
on. What I mean, like special operations, like, but we are programmed to, all right, we did this.
Yeah.
Hey, can we, how much further, faster can we go, right? And it's not because we're pushing the limits of risk, because we're pushing the capability.
And
it's a constant game of the capability has evolved to here.
Yeah.
And the next ridge line is how do we increase that speed, range, velocity, or distance to whether it's to reduce risk to the force or to be more lethal on the other end of that.
So, yeah, because the enemy's constantly training, right? Yeah. So you gotta up them all the time. Yeah, I mean,
like,
you know,
sniper rifles, like we're gonna get to a point where we exceed the range capabilities of the weapon systems we shoot.
Yeah,
we're gonna start doing things with parachutes and things to like increase the ranges of offsets that we're going to have to go to training areas just to do that specifically to accomplish those tasks, because the capability is just evolving.
How much longer you got at Zwick, do you think? Another year?
Another year.
Another year.
I mean,
do you have more goals that you want to put in place?
Like life goals? Army goals?
Army goals and Zwick goals.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, this is a great job. So I think really we are in a good place organizationally. I think a goal for me as a Sergeant Major I want to spend more time investing into the cadre leader development. So kind of a social contract of, you know, a team sergeant, a battalion, and a group sergeant major have sent us a cadre for 3 years to be an instructor. We owe them a product back of, you know, you sent us a sergeant first class, we're sending you back a team sergeant. So I definitely want to spend some energy this year. And we already do a very good job at it, but I would like to spend more time and energy, because I think the pipeline is good. We're doing a really good job assessing, selecting, and training people. How can we have a good relationship with the operational force that we're sending you, you give us good instructors and we send you back a good product. So guys have time to get the SWIC. Maybe, you know, they got, it's not a break, but they do get predictability, right? Like they work really, really hard. There's constantly courses and training going on, but they have some predictability and a schedule for their family that they can maybe spend some time investing in themselves. We as leaders can spend some time investing in themselves, and because we're going to send you back the group to a team and we're going to ask a lot of you, right? And maybe this time that we spend with them is a chance to, you know, look under the hood, do some maintenance, put a supercharger on it, and send it back to the force, right?
You never answered my question about what school would you want of all the schools in Zwick.
Oh, man. Like, I'm a student.
Yeah, you're a student.
I'm Lee Strong, E5, yep. graduating yep. the Q course.
What
would you want?
What would be your first pick?
Man. I mean, if I'm an E5 coming out of the Q course, just it'd be Sephardic or Hill School. Because
it'd have to be.
Because there's so there's only so many slots and everybody wants to go to them, right?
Like, and it's so applicable, right? Like, you go to free fall school, you might not jump, you're on a team, it's that, you know. Yeah.
I think other courses, there's time and opportunity, whereas those courses are such high demand, they're just hard to get.
Yeah.
Do I think that those two courses, operational relevancy, like Sephardic for sure and Lethality,
mm-hmm.
Halo School, we're absolutely going to train it. Whether or not we do it, I don't know. But we do some other courses out there that maybe are a little more like current operating environment. Mm-hmm. There's some other courses that are more operationally relevant, right?
Mm-hmm. Where would you work if you were E7, come up in SWCC orders? Where would you want to work?
Whew, man. So I'd work where my passion is, right?
Right.
So again, if I'm a guy that likes shooting sniper rifles, I want to go work at SIFSIC. Mm-hmm. If I'm a guy that likes,
but you personally,
me specifically, where I see an outsized impact for the long term benefit of the Special Forces Regiment would be the 18 X-ray kind of prep course,
mm-hmm.
because you are seeing every X-ray who at some point is going to go through the pipeline and go to every group,
and you're having an influence on them early on.
And you might be the first mm-hmm. NCO that they run, they bump into, and they get off the bus from mm-hmm. Fort Moore, right? And you spend 5 weeks with them, preparing them for assessment selection. Mm-hmm. The next one would be the Captain's Career Course or the 18 Alpha Course, because you're able to train and mentor captains that are going to go across the formation.
I would want to work, I think. I mean, I would pick sniper school again, but I think Robin Sage would be a fun place to work. I just think.
I'd go anywhere at SWCC. Yeah. And they're all like, every one of them is fun, man. Like, and even like Robin Sage, like Pineland.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, mm-hmm. if there's any Pinelanders out there listening, like, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, for your listeners that don't know what Pineland is, I mean, it is, there's no other exercise on the planet that is like Robin Sage.
Yeah.
And honestly, like that whole core, I mean, we're in Pineland right now.
Yeah, we are.
We are right on the edge of Pineland, right where your shop is. But I mean, that exercise is run off the goodwill and patriotism of those Pinelanders, mm-hmm. those great Americans that let us use their land, that role play and help us run that massive exercise that that quite frankly does something that that you can't produce anywhere else but Pineland, and it produces Green Berets.
And it works because the cultural awareness, all the lessons learned about building rapport and all that, they were heavily embedded with SF guys when they graduate, and it comes from that. Yeah, I got a bunch more questions, but we'll wrap it up. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about going to SF, if you're in the regular army or you're a civilian and you want to change your life, you know, you can give it a shot. The fear of failure is the worst reason not to do something.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's partly why I never went to CAG selection. But I learned from it. Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. And I'm really happy to learn how the force is and how SWCC is. Because I knew when you went there that you would have the right attitude and commitment and work ethic to steer things in the right direction, right? And it's a cultural change, right? You can change the culture in SWCC, and it's very, very, it permeates down to the whole force, and it just becomes a different place to work and a more positive kind of. I ran into a 18 Alpha student out at Cummins Creek there about a week ago, and he'd come up and talk to me. He recognized me, and I was just BSing with him, and I was like, "What do you think of the course?" And he was like, "Yeah, it's really good. It's a really good course." Like, and he was like, "There's a couple of little things, but there always is, right?" But he's like, "Overall, I'm very, very happy with it." You know, so that's a no way. In no small way due to your efforts, right? But you're shaping the mindset and the attitude below you. You know, I've been there. Like, it really does come from the top.
I think I'm just lucky to have an opportunity to be part of it, right? Like, you get one last opportunity. Like, the reality is I got less road ahead of me than I do behind me in the Army, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll never be on a team again, ever. And that kind of sucks when you say that out loud, right? But so what's the best
thing
you can do?
You have to accept it,
What's the best thing you can do to contribute to the force, right? And that's for me right now, it's at SWCC. And I'm not teaching students, but I can help from an organizational leadership standpoint of making the life a little easier on the cadre and the experience for the students a little better. And I'll tell you, man, it sounds cheesy, but I love my job, man. I drive to work every morning motivated, pumped up, and I come home feeling fulfilled because – you know, as I walk out of my office or out to Camp McCall, I am surrounded by the most motivated young men and women in the Army right now. They are on a journey doing some hard things that most Americans don't want to even consider doing for an opportunity to be like you and I and join this team.
Yep.
And to be around that environment is super fulfilling and motivating, right?
Yeah.
And then you go to the cadre and you see the care, compassion, and leader development that our cadre pour into those students. You're like, man, that's our formation, right? And to see that and be part of it's amazing. And then you walk around SWCC and you see the history, the lineage and legacy of, you know, you're at Nasty Nick or you're at the Sear compound and you see a quote from Nick Rowe, mm-hmm. or you walk into any one of the buildings named after one of our heroes, and it makes the hairs in the back of your neck stand up because you realize, like, man, you're just a small part of this larger thing called special operations, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you and I signed in the Q course, if you were to like drive to Camp McCall or go to you know our Bryant Hall and you look around, everything's changed.
Mm-hmm.
There's multi-million dollar buildings. Mm-hmm. There's new uniforms. You know, we've had every weapon system that we've had from the time you were on a team to now has changed. Every optic, every radio, every night vision device. There's so much change all around us. The vehicle platforms, you name it. And all that change, the one thing that I'd say is constant, remain true, is the people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything else has changed, but the people that come to our course to join this formation are amazing people. And if a candidate today from a candidate in 2000 when you and I were going through, mm-hmm. at a foundational level,
like same guy.
Intrinsic mm-hmm. motivation and core values mm-hmm. are just like you and I. And you see that when you snap link generations of our community together. We're not all that different, man.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. That is comforting to see that kind of that relationship and legacy from generation to generation. And you realize that really quick when you get in a room and you start talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a cool experience to be part of. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'd open up to any of the graybeards or veterans listening out there. You are pushing out an open door. Like, come on out, be part of it. And the students actually want to hear what you have to say, and they're going to benefit from your experiences. So, mm-hmm. You know, anybody wants to shoot me an email, phone call, or connect with you to me to get out there. But anybody wants to, you want to charge your battery, just park your car at Camp McCall for 30 minutes and watch. Yeah.
Well, I went through that recently when I worked with the Marine Corps, right? I'm teaching part-time for MARSOC. And I was out in Utah for a couple of weeks with the MARSOC Level 1 Sniper Course as an instructor, as a contractor. And just being in that community of those guys, super motivated, like crushing, hitting targets to 1,500 meters, like in high wind. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the best I've ever seen. And to be around that motivated community, it does recharge you. It really does. Because there's so much garbage going on in the country right now. It puts your faith back in America.
I turn the news on and you hear like the world's coming to an end, the sky is falling, and you get all that kind of background noise and negativity. And I could be in my living room watching news, hearing that, and it's 35 degrees out, and I'm hearing rain hit my roof, and I'm like, you know what? There's some candidates at Camp McCall pushing a Jeep in the sand right now.
Yeah.
Because it's Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or it's 100 degrees out in August, and there's somebody walking with a rucksack on their back. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think we're going to be okay as a formation and as a nation, because we have some amazing young men and women that are still willing to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And when you meet them, you see that right away, and it'll charge your battery, and you'll put some of that negative white noise behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one I'll tell you is just the families too, right? Like, you interact with our soldiers and team guys and gals, and that's amazing. And you realize when you meet their families, they are a reflection of those service members.
Mm-hmm.
The sacrifice and commitment from those spouses and kids is equally matched. And I think I'm just as much impressed in the family dynamic of the people we attract, but also who they are as a family.
It's network. A family commitment.
Yeah.
It just is. Yeah. Lee, thanks very much for coming in.
No, thanks,
that was
brother.
Great. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Always good seeing you, Kevin.
Make a comment if this is YouTube, make a comment below, freaking subscribe, and don't be lazy. And I'll try to get, if I can't answer it, I'll get Lee to answer it for me. I know you're super busy, man. You're running like freaking 100 schools, so I really appreciate you being here.
No, thanks,
you
brother.
So much. Okay, bye.